So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa Bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So carrying on from the right view, free from all speculative views, does the Buddha hold any speculative belief at all? And the idea of speculative belief, just to show a little funny story in the time of the Buddha, that one of the Buddha's chief lay disciples was a general who was called Citta. And Citta, the general, he was a non-returner, an anagami. And he went to see one of the Buddha's contemporaries called Mahavira. He was the leader of the Jaina tradition. It was a strange thing that the Jains and the Buddhists had their leaders at almost exactly the same time and almost exactly the same area of India. Mahavira had his center in Nalanda, and that was where Sariputta was born. So there was a lot of competition between those two groups, the Jains and the Buddhists. And so one day that Citta went to see Mahavira, and Mahavira welcomed him. Oh, look, this prominent disciple of Samana Gautama, that's what other people call the Buddha. And we were just having a discussion, he told Citta, about can you stop all thinking? What do you think about that? Or what's your idea of that? Do you believe that, Citta? And Citta said, no, I don't believe it at all. There you are, a prominent, learned, famous disciple of Siddhartha Gautama. Even he doesn't believe that you can stop thinking. It's just like putting your hand in the river Ganges, that you can stop the current of the Ganges with your fist. It's impossible. It can't be done. Yes, said Citta, I don't believe it. I know it, because I do it. At which point, Mahavira said, these disciples of the Buddha are very sneaky. It's very tricky. It's hard to have a decent conversation with them. But that illustrates the difference between belief and personal experience. Sometimes you don't like to call it personal experience, because person, self, but there's no other word. So in other words, you have that direct experience, your own experience, that is what the Buddha and the disciples actually do, rather than speculative belief. For the Buddha has put away, right? No, has seen this. Such is form, such its origin, such its disappearance. The body, where it comes from, its origin, its cause. Disappearance, why when the cause vanishes, so does the body. Such is experience, such is origin. Where does experience come from? Such is disappearance, such is perception, its origin, disappearance. Such is will. Where does will arise from? Not from you, not from myself. And when that cause of will disappears, so does the will. Such is origin, such is disappearance. Such are consciousnesses, six totally different types. This is where they arise, why they arise, what causes them. When those causes fall apart, consciousness vanishes. Therefore I say, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up. See all these words, destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up. So letting go, it's not attaining. And relinquishing of all conceptual proliferations. You know, this is the speculative speculative beliefs. Conceptual proliferations. You know, A leads to B leads to C leads to D, and oh, this must be the reason. All philosophizing, all eye-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendency to assuming a permanent essence, the Buddha is liberated through exhausting the fuel that drives rebirth. The three characteristics. Whether Buddhas arise or not, there persists that law, that stable Dharma, that fixed course of Dharma. All phenomena that arise from a cause are impermanent suffering and not a permanent essence. If it comes from a cause, it can't be permanent, and it's an irritation. A Buddha awakens to this and breaks through to it, then explains it, teaches it, proclaims it, establishes it, discloses it, analyzes it, and elucidates it. And what is it that the wise in the world agree upon as non-existing, of which I too say that it does not exist? Form, body that is permanent, stable and eternal, not subject to change. This the wise in the world agree upon as not existing. Permanent bodies. And I too say it does not exist. Experience, perception, will, consciousness, any type of this consciousness is any consciousness that is permanent, stable and eternal, not subject to change. This the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, and I too say it doesn't exist. It is impossible and inconceivable. These are all from the suttas. It is impossible and inconceivable that a person who is enlightened, or even on the path to enlightenment, even on the path to being a stream winner, could consider any phenomena that arises from a cause as permanent, as pleasurable, and as a soul. There's no such possibility. And what did the Buddha just say? Is something which arises from a cause. Those are the five components of existence. Your body, experience, can't have permanent experience. It comes from a cause. You can't have perceptions, will, even any type of consciousness. It's impossible and inconceivable the person who's enlightened or on the path of enlightenment can consider even consciousness, any type of consciousness, because it arises from a cause, as permanent, as pleasurable, as a soul, a permanent essence. But it is possible that an enlightened worldling, unenlightened worldling, might consider some phenomena that arise from a cause as permanent, as pleasurable, as a soul. There's such a possibility. That any kind of body, form whatsoever, any kind of experience, perception, any kind of will whatsoever, any kind of consciousness whatsoever, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, you're not special, as other people, so you, as you, other people, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all form, experience, perception, will, consciousnesses, as five components of existence, should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. You can't control it. It doesn't belong to you. It's nanya. This I am not. This is not a permanent essence. Next one. Mere suffering. Oh, this is one of my favorites. This is from the Visuddhimagga. Mere suffering exists. No sufferer is found. So if you're suffering, having a hard time, in pain, don't worry. It's just suffering. No one is suffering. Isn't that lovely? You can totally disengage. Not me. If you're happy, it's not you're happy, it's just happiness. Remember what I said, I want happiness. Take away the I, that's ego. Take away the want, that's craving. All you're left with is happiness. Just happiness exists. No one being happy. The deed is, but no doer of the deed is there. Now the next two are brilliant. Nibbana is, but not a person who enters it. You can't attain Nibbana. You have to disappear first, and then Nibbana's left. And the last one, my favorite of all, the path is, but no traveler on it is seen. So if you're walking the path, if you're trying to get deep meditation or jhanas, the path is so narrow you always fall off. But if the traveler disappears first of all, if you vanish, it's easy to meditate. I told a few people in interviews sometimes, it's like, how do I let go? How can I be not a traveler? Easy. It's like you're riding in the passenger seat, down Orchard Road, very busy traffic, and I tell you, take your hands off the steering wheel. Feel off the pedals. Let go.
Back on! I'll have a crash!
Take your feet off the pedals. Hands off the steering wheel. Well, try it. And they do. And it works. So, that's what you have to do. Just to let go. We don't, because we think everything will go wrong. But the Buddha is saying here, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. So when you start walking the path and travelling it, the path is so wide you can't fall off it. It is those who do not understand body, form as it really is, who do not know and see its origin and cessation, the way leading to its cessation, that think an enlightened one exists after death, or does not exist after death, or both exist and does not exist after death, or neither exists nor does not exist after death. In other words, they speculate about, annihilation or permanence. And of course, it's neither of those, it's in between. It's just this process which comes to cessation. Permanence, annihilation, is two extremes. Cessation of an empty process is the in-between. It is those who do not see experience as it really is, who do not see perception, will as it really is, who do not know and see consciousnesses as they really are, who do not know and see their origin, their cessation, and the way leading to their cessation. Remember, cessation, not annihilation. That think an enlightened one exists after death, or does not exist after death, or both exist as does not exist after death, or neither exists nor does not exist after death. After a while, it's like just, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled pepper. After a while, you get your sort of tongue around that one. But one who knows and sees form, experience, perception, will of consciousness as they really are, who does know and see their origin, where they come from. When the origin disappears, they fall apart, they cease. And the way leading to their cessation, they do not think an enlightened one exists after death, or does not exist after death, or both exist and does not exist after death, or neither exists nor does not exist after death. Now this passage, again, it's reaffirming this. Because this Yamaka, he had the idea that after death, the Buddha gets annihilated. And so they said, no, it's wrong. What do you think, Yamaka? Asked Sariputta. Do you regard the body, experience, perception, will, or consciousnesses, any one of those, as an enlightened one? No. Do you regard an enlightened one as somehow within the body? As inside experience, as inside perception, as within will or within consciousnesses? No, Venerable. Do you regard an enlightened one as separate from the body? As separate from experience? As separate from perception? As separate from will or as separate from consciousnesses? No, Venerable. Do you regard the body, experience, perception, will, and consciousnesses taken together as an enlightened one? No, Venerable. No, Venerable. Do you take an enlightened one as one who is without body, experience, perception, without will, without consciousnesses? No, Venerable. But Yamaka, when an enlightened one is not apprehended by you as real and actual here in this very life, is it fitting for you to declare that the enlightened one is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death? If Yamaka, they were to ask you what happens to an enlightened one with the breakup of their body after death, how would you answer? I would answer the body is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has just ceased and passed away. Experience is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Perception is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Will is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Consciousnesses are impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Good, Yamaka, good. If there is a view, the permanent, I think I mentioned this before, and I think it's a repeat. The permanent essence and the body are the same. There is no living of the holy life. And the reason is that when the body dies, the soul dies, it's a materialist philosophy. And so, whatever you do, bad people, good people, they all end up in the same place, in the box. And there's no result afterwards. It's the end of life, that's it. No karma, nothing. If that's your view, or if you view the permanent essence as one thing, the body is another, again, there's no living the holy life. It's as if the permanent essence is independent of the body, it's permanent, and it just goes on forever, no matter what you do. Without fearing to either of these extremes, the Buddha teaches Dhamma by the middle, dependent origination and dependent cessation. It's not permanent, it's not nothing, it's a process called dependent origination. And just up a bit more, I just missed a no. One who sees dependent origination and cessation sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination and cessation. It's one of the great sayings of the Buddha. If you understand this process, not persistence, not nothingness, this process, then you understand the Dhamma. The third option. Dependent origination, with delusion as cause, will the sankharas come to be. With sankharas as a cause, consciousnesses. With consciousness as a cause, name and form, the objects of consciousnesses. With name and form as a cause, the six sense bases. With six sense bases as a cause, sensory contact. With sensory contact as cause, experience. Now, some of these causes, you can see, they create something or they provide the cause for something arising in the next moment. But here, with consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, sensory contact, and experience, they all have to arise together. It's like the flame and the smoke and the heat and the light. If you have one, you have to have the other. So if you have consciousness, you have to have an object, the name and form, its objects. And part of those objects are supplied by six sense bases, sensory contacts, and experience. And with experience as cause, and also the delusion as well, there's a wanting. With wanting as cause, it's the fuel. With fuel as cause, states of existence. Now, it's not becoming, because states of existence, they have states of existence like manasabhava, the state of existence of being a man, the deva, bhava, the heavenly state of existence. And it's mentioned, it's very obvious, not very obvious, but if ever you can remember past lives or something, you actually create, the hells, if you want to, custom made, as you think you should be punished. If you go to heaven realm, you create the heaven realm where you feel that you can have a good time. So in the heaven realm, you don't always have to have ambrosia. In the Singaporean heaven realm, you can have dumpling, durian, yes, and dim sum. In my heaven realm, be fish and chips. I don't know, whatever you like. So it is not sort of the same for everybody, because your wanting creates these, the mind-made realms. So a ghost, what does a ghost actually experience? Well, they want what they expect to experience. But what's really fascinating in this realm, how much of this realm, the human realm, is actually created by the mind? And how much is it created? Just now, it's just there, you just have to experience it. How much is it objective? And how much is it created? And it reminds me, the novice seminary Chittananda who left this afternoon, going back home after 3 months, in her card she reminded me of Schrodinger's cat. This wonderful experiment. She gave me a little drawing of it. This, again, is what something which blew my mind when I first heard of this. And it's very, very convincing. It's true. It happens. It's one of the basis of quantum computing. Schrodinger, Erwin Schrodinger, he devised an experiment. He never performed it. Thank goodness, that'd be very cruel. But he visualized it and wrote it down. What if you take a cat, put it in a box, closed box, you know, you've got some enough air in there, but you put a cyanide capsule in a box. And the cyanide capsule is broken and the cat is murdered, killed, according to like the decay of like a cesium atom. If it decays, the cat's dead. If it doesn't decay, the cat's alive. And there's a 50% chance, because quantum process is 50%. It's like maybe, maybe not. You can't actually predict it. It's just probability. And so, after a certain time, when there's a 50% chance of the cat being alive or dead, it's still in the box, you haven't opened the box yet, what state is the cat in? And it, there are two possibilities, two interpretations. The Copenhagen interpretation is the cat is not dead, the cat is not alive. The cat is in a third state, neither alive nor dead, until someone opens the box. And only then, the cat collapses the Schrodinger equation and it becomes either alive or dead. But in the meantime, before you open the box, it's not alive, it's not dead, it's neither. Now that is like gobbledygook, it doesn't make any sense to those with speculative views. But actually that's the truth of the matter. The alternative is even more weird. That's where you get parallel universes. In one universe it's alive, another one it's dead. It depends on which universe you tend to go in. But there's another universe, if you open it and it's alive, another universe suddenly is created where it's dead.
Why is the cyanide tablet there?
Because you've got to have it, otherwise you know it's alive. You've got to have something with a 50-50 chance of it being alive or being dead. So that's the answer to the old philosophical question. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is there to hear it or see it, has it fallen? And quantum theory say it's not fallen, it's not upright. We don't know yet. It's actually in the in-between state. Or, good, Sister Chanda's not here. This is a totally misogynist joke. You can take it off the recording afterwards. Based on that, there was the old saying, if a husband speaks and his wife is not there to hear him, is he right? Is he wrong?
Is he right?
No, it's neither right nor wrong. But is he wrong? But anyway, the tree falling in the forest. This is weird. But we're actually creating the world. It's amazing just how much of this world we create. And that's a weird thing of quantum physics, and that's a weird thing when you understand the nature of the mind. If you think, no, I can't get enlightened, of course you won't. It's amazing just how that self-doubt will really block you. It can't happen, but if I convince you, you can. There's a good chance. If the Singapore football team is playing, I don't know, Brazil or something, or Germany, world champions. Who's a world champion? I don't know, but if they're playing, say, Germany. And if the coach comes up to tell the Singapore football team, oh, you haven't got a chance. You're not going to win. There's the world champions. You know, but yeah, just play the best you can. But don't worry about, you know, if they score 10 goals against you. If a coach says that, of course you're going to lose. If the coach says, well, the ball's round, they've got 22 legs, you've got 22 legs, who knows? A good coach creates belief. And with belief, actually it's amazing, just we actually go past what we think is humanly possible. It answers those questions. When you see in sports, like Olympic Games, why is it that people keep on breaking the records every year. It's a world record. And next year, we create another world record. It seems almost like physically impossible. The human body can only do so much. But the mind creates more speed, more strength. It's amazing how much that is the mind-based. So it's mind, it creates states of existence, even in this world. If you're really negative, and think, oh, it's going to be the end of the world, ooh, I'm going to get sick, ooh, I'm going to die, ooh, you do die. But if you have a positive attitude, no, it's not. Then you create a huge amount of positive energy, which actually is not just psychological. It is powerful, it works. Wanting is a fuel which creates states of existence. And in particular, rebirth, aging, death, sorrow, crime, pain, unhappiness, and distress come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. And here he is. No God, no Brahma can be called the maker of life. Empty phenomena roll on, dependent on conditions all. You see what makes the empty phenomena roll on. But when a meditator has abandoned delusion, aroused true knowledge, then with the fading away of delusion and the arising of true knowledge, you do not generate meritorious volition or a demeritorious volition or a neutral volition. Just do your duties until you fade away. But with the remainless fading away and cessation of delusion, this is dependent cessation. Delusion, not ignorance. Because ignorance, for that first word, Ouija, never made any sense to me. Because people today aren't ignorant. Many people know the Four Noble Truths, can say them in Pali, in Hokkien, in Cantonese, in Mandarin, and they can recite them backwards. They're not ignorant of them. They haven't penetrated them. There's a delusion there. When a meditator has abandoned delusion and aroused true knowledge, then with the fading away of delusion and the arising of true knowledge, you do not generate a meritorious volition or a demeritorious volition or a neutral volition. You do not. You do nothing. The doer is starting to stop. But with the remainder is fading away, cessation of delusion comes cessation of will. Cessation of will, cessation of consciousness, cessation of name and form, cessation of six sense bases, cessation of sensory contact, cessation of experience, cessation of wanting, cessation of fuel, cessation of states of existence, cessation of rebirth, cessation of rebirth, aging and death, sorrow, crying, pain, unhappiness and distress. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. House builder, you have now been seen. You should build no houses again. Your rafters has been broken, your gables all torn. Thrown off course, the jitta, the mind, will be destroyed right here. Without any doubt, jitta, you shall be destroyed. Ending. Vanished. Because the cause is, the house builder has been seen. That was the right view. It's maybe not what you expect. If it was what you expect, if it was what you understand and know, you wouldn't need to be here. You'd be a stream winner. So if you don't understand it, wonderful. But you think, well, it's a bit much for me. I'm terribly sorry, but it's too late now. You now have been brainwashed. It's got in there. And when it's in there, there's something about that. Yes. I don't like it, but it's actually what the Buddha said. And maybe it's actually according to science as well. Maybe it's true. And gradually it eats into you. It eats away all your defilements and stuff. One of the nice things, you say, one of the strange things, when I first heard the Four Noble Truths, I thought, it's all suffering. But why the heck, you go and see someone like an Ajahn Chah, he's so happy. It made no sense. You know, he's supposed to be suffering. Now, this is, you know, people call it the nihilistic negative path. And why do people who practice it and become arahats, why are they so damn happy? That was really weird. Until you get to understand that having that that right view is where your smile comes from. Right motivation. So once you've got the view right, then right motivation. I learned this studying the Vinaya. I talked with lawyers. And you know, it's the same in most legal systems. An act has a motivation and an intention. The motivation is where the act is coming from. What made you do that? Well, you had ill will, or you thought it was a good idea at the time, kindness, delusion, greed, jealousy. Where it comes from, the motivation. The intention is where it's heading to. Where are you going to go with that? What do you want to achieve or get? So once you have the right view, the 84 path, the right motivation, where you're coming from, is it really out of greed, personal vendetta, or is it, you know, just out of compassion, selflessness? Where's it coming from? That decides whether it's good karma or bad karma. Where it coming from, the motivation. Where it leads to, the intention. If there's no intention at all, in other words, it's accident, there's no karma at all. You know, just unintentionally, you're not really thinking. And, oops, that was an insect. That was a mosquito. There's no intention. You didn't know what you're doing. You weren't mindful. So no intention, no karma at all. Intention is karma. Good or bad is motivation. So what now is right motivation? Actions of body, speech and mind which come from a motive of renunciation, letting go, a motive of kindness coming from a motive of gentleness. This is called right motivation. It's Sammasankappa, the second factor of the Eightfold Path. It's not thought, it's motivation, what's behind the thought, what pushes the thought into existence. So that's the motivation. Letting go, kindness and gentleness. And if you haven't got coming from the right place, then of course, things are going to go terribly wrong. If you're not trying to, if you're trying to get something out of meditation, trying to be a big shot, trying to be the saviour of the Buddhist world, the first English arahat. That sort of stuff, that's coming from a wrong motivation. It's not renunciation, it's what's in it for me. It just makes you a bigger ego. And you don't get anywhere except the big egos. That's the Devadatta. And you can see, unfortunately, many spiritual leaders actually get lost in that. It's not about renunciation, it's amassing more power and fortune. Coming from a motive of kindness. Kind to your body. Don't be just, I'm going to force my body. Body, I've been kind to you too long, I'm going to sit here and behave. Or kind to your friends. You don't shout at people. Come on, sit properly. Don't do that. Sit properly. Oh, you poor thing, you're tired. Do you want another cushion underneath it? You're kind. That is not just messing around. That is directly from the Buddha's words. And when sometimes people ask me, say, well, compassion, compassion. Where in the Eightfold Path is compassion? Kindness. Because if you just look at it, if the old translations, right view, right act, right view, right thought, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right consciousness, where's the compassion there? It's there in the second factor of the Eightfold Path. And the second factor is kindness. Motivation. Kindness is where you're coming from. If it's kindness, it works. So kindness and gentleness. Please be gentle to your body. If you're tired, take a rest. If you're sick, don't force it. Just take a break. Be kind and be gentle to your body. It's amazing just how that gives you so much energy. And what is unwholesome motivations? The opposite. Instead of letting go, desire for the world of the five senses, greed, getting somewhere, getting just a gold lame sparkly robe. Look how I've made it as a monk. Look how you've made it in the world. That's desire for that world of five senses, of aversion, getting really upset and angry, and cruelty. The reason they come up is because you're coming from a sense of self, of me, of I. And when you have a sense of I, then you will want something. People get in your way, you get angry, and eventually you get cruel. When your sense of self vanishes, or it diminishes, that's of course you get letting go of kindness and gentleness. You don't want anything. So, from where do these unwholesome motivations originate? There arise from perception of desire for the world of five senses. Where they arise from perceptions of aversion and of cruelty. Where do these unwholesome motivations cease without remainder? In the first jhana. Motivations, you've got no motivation there anymore. The unwholesome ones stop. The only wholesome motivation left in that first jhana is the moving on to the object. What are the wholesome motivations? Motivations of renunciation, kindness and gentleness. From where do these wholesome motivations originate? They arise from perceptions of renunciation, kindness and gentleness. Where do those wholesome motivations cease without remainder? In the second jhana. Later on, if you haven't noticed already, the first jhana, five senses anymore, but there is still what I call the wobble, the movement of the mind onto the bliss, holding on to it, is a movement still there, only subverbal, not thinking. It's that motivation, still some movement. In the second jhana, all motivations, all things which move the mind into thinking or wanting, that's all gone. Perfect stillness. Because there's sometimes when people say there's thinking in jhana, this proves it's not at all. Even if you call it the old translation, Sammasankapha's thinking, thinking ceases. At least in the second jhana. But even in the first jhana, there's nothing much there. So, now, for those people who have been discombobulated, this is now coming back to your real life. What now is right speech? Right speech is refraining from lying, malicious gossip, harsh speech, from useless chatter. So, here we go, abstaining from lying. What is lying? You abandon lying and abstain from false speech. If you are summoned to a court and questioned as a witness thus, so tell me what you know. Then not knowing you say I don't know, or knowing you say I do know, not seeing you say I do not see, or seeing you say I do see, you're honest. So, scroll please. Thus you do not consciously speak falsehood for your own ends or for another's ends or for some trifling worldly end. So that's a cause of lying. You know, it's in your interest to lie. You have benefit from it. Or for benefit of somebody else, or from some trifling worldly end. It's a nice little story which I read. I think somebody told me about that during the Second World War, I think in a place like Amsterdam or somewhere, there was a Dutch man who was sheltering a Jewish family, you know, from the Gestapo, who were rounding up the Jewish people and sending them to death camps. But he was such an honest person that when the Gestapo knocked at his house and they asked him, have you got any Jewish people hiding in your house? He was honest. He couldn't lie. So he just said, come in and have a look for yourself. Thank you, sir. We'll go next door. Apparently it was true. He's such an honest person, he's so open, whatever you want to say, that they believed he couldn't be hiding anything.
his morality, virtue, saved him. And that family too. Really interesting story. Would not lie. And to be a deliberate lie, you know, you have to know what you're doing. You must say, I'm going to speak falsely. While speaking, you must be aware I'm telling a lie, and afterwards you are aware that I have misrepresented the truth. It has to be to deceive a person. So when I tell, when that person wrote that question last night, two nights ago I dreamt I was a piece of ravioli. That was not a conscious lie. That wasn't deceiving anybody. If you believe that, I mean, you must have been really a bit dumb. So it means you're deceiving somebody, not just telling a joke. There were Buddhist jokes. Because you know jokes, they always usually say that somebody walks into a bar. So these three Buddhists go into a bar. Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta walk into a bar. Dukkha speaks first, and Dukkha says, this bar sucks, this bar's terrible, this bar's awful. Anicca says, don't worry, it will change. Anatta said, who said that? The Buddhist joke. Anyway, but that never happened. I'm not deceiving anybody. So that doesn't count as a lie. Malicious gossip. You abandon malicious gossip and abstain from talk that causes division. Having heard something, you do not repeat it in order to divide people for one another. You know, the politics and the spin. The office politics. Instead, you are one who reunites those who are divided. A promoter of unity, who enjoys concord, reduces in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. And I gave an example of that the other day, when Irana Wibhanga said, you never criticize a person. You never said that was a stupid kid who dropped the jar of honey. It was a stupid thing you did. That's not malicious. That's helpful. Abstaining from harsh speech. Having abandoned harsh speech, you abstain from harsh speech. You speak words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable. Words that go to the heart are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. So, amazing kind words. You get much, much further in life by just being kind. There's a woman who, her co-worker got promoted and became her boss. And as soon as she became a boss, she became a real pain in the neck. And always asking her to do this and do that. And one day, at lunch, she got a nice cup of coffee for her new boss. She knew what she liked. Said, here you are, I was in the coffee shop, this is for you. And just that bit of kindness changed the whole relationship. And they're speaking words that are gentle, lovable, go to the heart, courteous, desired by many, agreeable to many. And they've got this beautiful relationship, the boss and the worker, just because they were kind. You don't need to shout at a person to actually to get something done. Even if terrorists, this is the simile of the saw. Now, even the... Oh, no, this is the old version. No, okay. The new version, which was, even if terrorists were to torture you, such as savagely cutting off your head with a serrated kitchen knife. Because no one saws off people's limbs with a two-handled saw anymore. One who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. And when I first saw that, I thought, well, that's going a bit far. Who could do that? But then, you know, I remember just reading a story about a Tibetan monk, you know, who was put in a jail and was tortured. He escaped. And when he was interviewed, you know, he said throughout the whole time he was being tortured by the guards, you know, he remembered that simile. And he remembered, I'm not going to allow you to create anger or ill will in my mind towards you. If I do that, then you have beaten me. And even in severe pain, that he still managed, apparently, what he said, to always give kindness to his torturers. It proved it could be done. And that means that, he won. They could torture his body, but his mind was above all of that. He had his integrity. Instead, you should train yourself thus. My mind will remain unaffected. I shall speak no bad words. I shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. I shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, I shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. That is how you should train. I think I said last night, there was a video which somebody sent me of a man who approached a policeman in a Thai police station. Ping Pong sent it to me. And, did I say that last night? Okay. Nice little video. A guy came into the police station somewhere in Bangkok, holding a knife, and the policeman was there. I did say last night, wasn't it? Yeah, but anyway, the policeman was threatened with a knife. So he just moved back maybe one step and sat on the table. Now I folded his arms, oh, what's the matter? And his whole body language was not aggressive, it was just like friendly. And his tone of voice showed no fear, but compassion. And after a couple of minutes, he just said, give me the knife, and he handed over the knife. And as soon as he handed over the knife, this person, the policeman just, very slowly, got off the table, not to arrest him, but just put his arms around him and give this guy a big hug. And they sat there, well, what's up? And then the guy said, he's lost his job a few days ago. And, he did make a bit of money playing guitar. Someone stole his guitar. He was just really fed up. So they gave him some water to drink. And I think somebody had a guitar or something which was either stolen or no one had claimed or something. Oh, you have this guitar. It's ours. It's on us. And he said, thank you. And they never pressed charges. All the best to you. And that was just such beautiful emotional intelligence. Just kindness instead of actually shooting them. It's because you've got a knife in your hand. So it's a very... Maybe I'll send it to you, Eileen, and then you can share it around. Anyone wants it. It's very nice. Anyway, so that's... You don't sort of have that fierceness which creates more problems. Kindness which goes to the heart. Abstaining from useless chatter. Having abandoned useless chatter, you abstain from unbeneficial talk. You speak at a proper time, truth, what is beneficial. Speak on the Dhamma and discipline. At a proper time, you speak words that are worth recording, reasonable, succinct, and beneficial. So, words that are beneficial. It's not always talking about Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. Sometimes just saying, how's your family right now? You see somebody is a bit upset, you just tell a stupid joke. And that makes people happy. Even beneficial, kids come to the temple. And the kids, they're just, always noisy. So, can you help? Ajahn Brahm said, oh yeah, it's very easy. And I said, okay, sit down here, child, and they're bored. And they're just playing around. Do you want to earn $20? Okay, yeah, $20. Okay. And I said, okay, I'll give you $20 if you can keep quiet until I finish counting to 10. They'll do that. Even kids have got greed. $20. But they don't know how sneaky a monk can be. So they sit down there and I go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They're very quiet. 6, 7, 8, 9. I have to go to Singapore on the 28th, so... has all the arrangements been made yet, Eileen? Or did you manage to get that receipt sorted out? Well, and you can see that. Come on, Ajahn, come on. And I never finish. I never get to the last number. They had to remain quiet. It depends on how greedy they are. How quiet they are. But afterwards, they come to the temple again. It's a bit good fun. It just shows them a little bit of Dhamma, you know, just from the an interesting, fun perspective. I think I've got Ben on that, you know, your nephew once in Singapore. He was talking so much in the back of the car. I promised him $20, and I never got to 10. He started talking first. But we know he had about 3 or 4 minutes of quiet. Yeah. Okay. Right way to criticize someone. Now, this is in the office, any business, any sort of monastery. Sometimes you have to tell somebody that what they're doing, give them some feedback. So what do you do before giving feedback? Before you criticize someone, you should be mindful with respect to 5 things and carefully establish 5 things. Is my bodily behavior pure? Do I possess bodily behavior that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable? Does this quality exist to me or not? If your bodily behavior is not pure and you do not possess bodily behavior that is pure, the latest version is much more... it's a much newer one. But anyway, it doesn't matter, it's good enough. Be content and easily satisfied, Ajahn Brahm, before I criticize somebody. Is my body behavior, if your body behavior is not pure, you do not possess body behavior that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable, there will be those who say of you, please train your own body behavior first. Is my behavior of speech pure? Do I possess behavior of speech that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable? Does this quality exist in me or not? If your behavior of speech is not pure, you do not possess behavior of speech that is pure, flawless, and irreproachable, there will be those who say of you, please train your own speech first. Have I established a mind of loving kindness without resentment to my associates? Does this quality exist in me or not? If you have not established a mind of loving kindness without resentment to your associates, there'll be those of you who say, please establish a mind of loving kindness without resentment to your advice first. In other words, you know, your body, speech, and mind. Before you criticize somebody else, you know, just look at yourself first of all. Make sure that, you know, you have trained yourself. Otherwise, you've just got no power. If you get angry at somebody, you know, because they've done something very wrong, people only hear your anger. They don't hear what you're saying. They just see, oh, he's angry at me again. How am I learned? This is like to monks and nuns. Do I retain and understand what I have learned? Have I learned much about those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, which proclaim the perfectly complete and pure spiritual life? Have I retained them in mind, mentally investigated them, and understood them properly? Does this quality exist in you or not? If not, there will be those who say of you, please learn your own tradition first. Basically, do you know what you're talking about? So easily, people criticize other people, and they haven't really got a basis. They haven't got authority because they haven't learned what they're criticizing others for. Have both monastic codes, I mean the rules, the laws, whatever, have they been well learned and understood by me? Does this quality exist in me or not? If not, there'll be others who say, if you please learn the monastic rules first. And that's one of the reasons when I did that bhikkhuni ordination, it was very hard for people to criticize me because they know that I knew those rules better than almost anybody. You know, that I spent years studying those and writing books about them, about the Vinaya. And so they were a bit concerned, oh, we better not criticize this person. You know, he knows more than we do. So that's important. You're coming from a knowledge base, an experience base, and your bodily actions and speech are pure, and you come from kindness, not trying to sort of put somebody down or diminish them. And also, 6, you resolve to speak at a proper time, not an improper time. In other words, you don't just grab somebody just when they're really busy and say, I need to talk to you, you did this, because that's the wrong time, they haven't got time for that. So I would say, if you need to sort of say something to your partner, and at home, take them out for dinner, first of all. Give them their favorite 3-course or in Chinese 9-course lunch, dinner, whatever it is. At the end of the last course, you can ask them anything. That's really the proper time to criticize your husband. When he's really just all soft because his tummy is full. Or your wife. So not the proper time, not in the proper time. So you wait for the occasions when somebody is in a good mood, and then you can ask them. Monks know that. You know, if they want to ask for something, sometimes they ask after lunch, especially if it's been a very nice lunch. They know what I like. A really nice lunch, they come and ask, and oh, yeah, sure. If it's some rotten lunch, and I'm really tired, then they come around, they're just going to say no. It's obvious. So, resolve to speak truthfully, not falsely, speak gently, not harshly, in a beneficial way, not in a way that causes harm, with a mind of loving kindness, not while harboring ill will. You know, focus on the act, not the person. Those are the 10 ways of right speech. Now, right action, I think we'd have to probably start that tomorrow, because it's 4 or 5 o'clock now. And I have to get back to monastery tomorrow, just to remind everybody. Tomorrow it's the full moon day. It's called Pawarana Day. The Pawarana Day is that we have to do a ceremony which marks the end of the rains retreat. The Katina is a celebration which people always do on a Sunday in the month after the Pawarana Day. So because of that, there's going to be a ceremony, which is for the residents from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock. So because of that, the sutta class tomorrow, 1 hour early, from 3 to 4, or just before, 3 to 10 to 4. So then I'll just go over to monastery. They have to wait for me, so if I'm late... they have to endure. So that's 3 p.m. tomorrow. And because of that, can't have interviews tomorrow afternoon. And even in the morning, I think I mentioned to people, sometimes they catch me just after lunch when I'm in a good mood, and I say yes to things I really should look at my calendar first of all. And I admit to gross hypocrisy, because it's a wedding tomorrow morning I'm supposed to bless. After all the jokes I've said about weddings. So that's happening at 9:30. I've got to be in monastery. So after the morning talk again, please no interviews. So I'm sorry for that. But to make up for it, on Friday, so we can have an extra half an hour of interviews starting at 3 o'clock to 4 p.m. instead of 3:30 to 4 p.m. But after 4 p.m. as well, on Friday afternoon, then I go to Nolamara for the first Friday talk after the rains. And variety is a spice of life, as they say. So Friday evening, that's tomorrow evening, you have the pleasure of Ajahn Bhumali to interrogate. Yeah. So he'll be here asking questions. And the Saturday morning, he'll be giving the session from 9 till 10. I'll still be in town. Exactly how we're going to do that, PJ, where he's... Oh, he's going to let me know how many people are leaving, don't need your names, when they're leaving, so we know actually when to do the last metta meditation, either on a Friday or Saturday evening. I'll be back in Saturday afternoon, so whenever it's most convenient. So remember, things are just always so uncertain. We always change here and change there. It's called impermanence. Yeah. So... sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay. So remember, the talk tomorrow is still 9 o'clock till 10.